Oh. Raise your hand if you don't have one and would like one. Have you already handed some out?
Yeah.
That's okay, good. I was like, nobody wants one? I was like, man, we've lost it. It's the time this series ended. We've clearly lost interest. We've come to John. Does anybody remember our memory verse from this morning and can quote it? Miss Sue, I saw your hand. John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's one of those verses, it's like the same in every translation. So no matter what you memorized it in, that's what it says. So John 1:1. It just occurred to me, I've not given thought to next week's memory verse, so it will be forthcoming, either in Friday features or Wednesday night, or I'll get it to you. John 1:1. Well, you see this morning by the screen, we have a lengthy title this morning, The Gospel According to John, Relationship to the Synoptics, and the Basic Structure and Outline. We'll explain what that means as we go. So number one on your handout, relationship to the synoptics. Now, as we come to our fourth and last gospel, I think many Christians would say that we've saved the best for last. Raise your hand if you would say John is your favorite gospel. I see that hand. I don't think God minds you having favorites as long as you don't disparage the others. Now, here's the thing. If you've been reading Mark and Matthew and Luke, as I hope you have, because it occurred to me that I forgot to encourage you to read Luke as we were going through it. Maybe you assumed that I meant that, but I would now encourage you to be reading John in the next couple weeks if you haven't been already. But if you've been reading Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and you come to John, the most obvious thing, the thing that hits you in the face, is simply how different John is from the other three. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that, I don't think. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in fact, are similar enough to each other that there's a name for them. We call them the Synoptic Gospels. Somebody asked me, I accidentally used that word earlier in the series without explaining it. Somebody asked me what it meant. Synoptic Gospels, when we refer to the Synoptics, we're referring to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The word synoptic means seeing together. You hear the word optic, see, and sign. Sin means with. So like seeing together. So it's like you can lay Matthew, Mark, and Luke together alongside each other and see their similarities. And I think we've done that in this series. They all three share Mark's basic outline. They trace Jesus' ministry from Galilee to his climactic journey to Jerusalem, where he dies and rises again on the third day. And they all three tell many of the same stories in the same order often. That's why we began with Mark in this series, where we got the basic outline. And then we moved a little further away from Mark with Matthew, who adds a new intro and a new conclusion and adds five big teaching blocks to it. And then we moved a little further than that with Luke, who adds a different new intro and a different new conclusion, who adds a whole bunch of new parables and stuff in the middle of his gospel. But when we come to John, we've clearly left Mark far behind. John is a whole other ballgame. Now, let me remind you, the title of this series was Four Portraits, One Jesus, not Four Jesuses. So I'm not saying that John gives us a totally different Jesus, not at all. But we do want to focus this morning first on the obvious differences between John and the Synoptics. Because when we read horizontally from John to the Synoptics, it's those differences that stand out to us the most, I think. I've listed eight on your handout. Eight differences. Number one, first, he, that is John, omits much of the material found in the Synoptics. He omits, he leaves it out. Many stories that are recorded in all three of the Synoptic Gospels are absent from John. Can anyone name some of them? Man, where's this jacket? I'm doing whatever Chris was doing last week. OK, Can anyone name some of those stories that are in all three of the other Gospels but that aren't in John? No, not quite. But you're in the ballpark. Anybody else? Are you waiting for me to get the microphone changed? Sure, we'll go for that. On. Birth narrative. There's no story of Jesus' birth like there is in Matthew and Luke. There's one. Parables. You may have noticed, Brother Paul, when you were doing your parable series, you weren't in John very much. It's because there's basically no parables in John, even though they're all over the synoptics. Oh, okay. It's right here. Where's the thing at? So basically no parables in John, even though you do have like parabolic language, like I am the door and I am the shepherd and things like that. But no parables as we see them in the others. What else? Stuff that's in the others but not in John. Okay, I'll get the ball rolling more here. Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist. Not there. John, he hits all around it. He even tells us that he beheld the Spirit descend like a dove on Jesus. But he never actually tells us that John the Baptist baptized Jesus. Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, right after his baptism. Not in John's gospel either. Exorcisms. The other three gospels all the time talk about Jesus going around casting out demons from people. No exorcisms in John. Although John does tell us in chapter 12 that Jesus says, now is the judgment of this world, now is the prince of this world cast out. So John does sort of tell us how Jesus, where his authority comes from to cast devils out. It comes from his death and resurrection, from who he is. But no exorcisms in John's gospel. Very little mention of the kingdom of God. In the other Gospels, the kingdom of God is one of the main themes of Jesus' teaching and preaching. I think it gets mentioned twice in John, both of them with his conversation with Nicodemus that Pastor Chris preached last week. But other than that, Jesus doesn't talk about the kingdom in John. Instead of speaking of entering the kingdom of God, John speaks of having eternal life, which is sort of like John's equivalent of the kingdom of God. Think of what that turning point event in Mark's gospel was. Turning point in Matthew's gospel that's not in John. Peter's confession of Jesus as the Christ at Caesarea Philippi, Mark 8. Big deal in all the first three gospels. Not in John. He doesn't have it. The transfiguration. Jesus goes up on the mountain with Moses and Elijah. He's transfigured. He glows like the sun. It's not in John. The Last Supper, in which Jesus breaks the bread and gives the cup. Not in John. A list of the 12 apostles. The other three Gospels all provide a list of all 12 apostles and tells you their names. John doesn't have that list. He does speak at one point of the 12. He knows that there's 12 apostles. He knows he was one of them. But he doesn't name the 12 apostles in a list. That also enables him not to mention his own name, as we saw when we talked about the author of the book. John refers to himself as the beloved disciple, but he never actually mentions his own name in the Gospel of John, which is probably why he's the only one who can refer to John the Baptist simply as John. When you read John chapter 1, he speaks of John the Baptist as John, not talking about himself there. He's talking about John the Baptist. But he doesn't have to distinguish himself because he never mentions himself by name. So there's lots of stuff that he omits that the other three have. Number two, he includes much material that is not contained in the synoptics. He includes much material. What would fall into that category? What is some stuff that's in John that's not in any of the others? And here you've got a wide range of stuff you could pick from.
Well, the prologue at the very beginning.
What we call the prologue, the first 18 verses that we quoted
that Miss Sue quoted for us in the memory verse. Not any others. What else? Go ahead.
The story of Nicodemus, the well.
Read the first five chapters of John, and pretty much anything in the first five chapters is not there, which would include the story of Nicodemus, woman at the well, the calling of Philip and Nathanael in chapter 1, the healing of the official's son in chapter 4, the healing of the lame man at the pool, chapter 5,
turning the water into
wine, chapter 2, not in the others. You keep going, Jesus, his healing of the man born blind in chapter 9, the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11, washing the disciples' feet, chapter 13, not in the others. Story of doubting Thomas, chapter 20, not in the others. His meeting with the disciples by the lakeside in chapter 21. You know, Peter, do you love me? Not in any of the others. Pretty much, if you look at Jesus' discourses, his sermons, his dialogues, pretty much all the discourses in John are unique to John. Pretty much, just take your pick, pretty much everything he says. The bread of life discourse in chapter 6, the light of the world discourse in chapter 8, the good shepherd discourse in chapter 10, the whole upper room discourse in chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, it's all unique to John. You lose John, you lose a lot, because there's a lot of unique stuff here. So even though John tells basically the same big story about Jesus, his ministry, his making enemies, working miracles, dying on the cross, rising again, same big story, but he basically tells it through an almost entirely different set of little stories. So there is only one miracle, not counting the resurrection of Jesus, there's one miracle that occurs in John in all four Gospels. Anybody know what it is?
The feeding of the 5,000.
Feeding of the 5,000. That's it. The one miracle that's in all four. So he omits much of the material found in the synoptics. He includes much material that's not there. Number three, this is just an issue of style here. He just tells fewer stories overall. He tells fewer stories overall. Just compared to the others, when you read John, there's just a lot fewer episodes, period. In fact, and this is, I didn't test this scientifically, but I would encourage you. You could probably open Mark or Matthew to any given page, and you'd have more episodes, more stuff happening on those two pages than almost all of John put together. Right? There's just less there, especially when you think of John chapter 5 through 10. And you read the outline there, there's fewer stories, but they're longer. They take longer to tell. In fact, John seems to follow this pattern of Jesus works a miracle, people respond to it, either positively or negatively, and then he talks about it. So you got this action, miracle, response, sermon. Miracle, response, sermon. And you see this pattern, chapter 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So in one sense, not a lot happens in those chapters because the episodes just take longer. John spends more time on each one. So he tells fewer stories overall. Number four, and related to that, John presents Jesus' words in lengthy dialogues instead of parabolic statements. Lengthy dialogues rather than parabolic statements. Now, Jesus talks a lot in John. If you got a red letter version, there's a lot of red in John, pages on end. But the form is different than in the other three. We mentioned earlier there's no parables, really, in John's gospel. So instead of giving us these pithy parables and statements, John gives us lengthy, sometimes monologues, where Jesus just does all the talking, but more often it's dialogues. You'll notice, like the one Chris preached last week, dialogue with Nicodemus, chapter 4, he's going to preach this morning, dialogue with the woman at the well, chapter 8 is a dialogue with the Jews in which Jesus gets really rough with them. And even in a lot of the upper room discourse in chapters 14, 15, 16, you look in there and there's actually a lot of back and forth, the apostles asking him questions or interjecting things that Jesus responds to. So there's just a lot of lengthy dialogue in John. So that's whether we're talking about Jesus' deeds or his words, The pattern we see in John is something like less and lengthier. Less and lengthier. There's less there, but he spends more time on each thing. It's a different style in that way. Number five, he focuses less on Jesus' ministry in Galilee and more on his ministry in, anybody guess what it is? Jerusalem. More on his ministry in Jerusalem. Now, the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, focus mainly on Jesus' ministry in and around Galilee, and then they have him making this one climactic journey to Jerusalem at the end where he dies, and it spends a lot of time on his final week there. Whereas John, on the other hand, has Jesus making at least three different trips to Jerusalem at the Passover time. At least three different ones. Chapter 2, verse 13, chapter 6, verse 4, and then finally chapter 11, verse 55. At least three times. Incidentally, this is where people get the idea that Jesus' ministry lasted 3.5 years. You know, this is very common. You ask somebody, how long did Jesus' public ministry last? Easy, 3.5 years. And we often speak of this, you know, he started when he was about 30, died when he was about 33. And we often speak of this as though it were like a well-established fact, but it's actually not that well-established a fact. It really just comes from the idea that John gives us three Passover trips to Jerusalem. And when you think about that, that doesn't have to mean 3 years. It could mean as little as two. You could have one Passover at the end, one at the beginning, one at the end, and one in the middle with 2 years. We don't know. Or, since Matthew, Mark, and Luke only tell us about one Passover, when clearly there were more, for all we know, John might be leaving some out too. So we can't say dogmatically we know Jesus' ministry lasted 3.5 years. But this is where it came from. I even told Bubba the other night when we were he ate supper with us. I was like, Bubba, Jesus died when he was about our age. Because he told me it was his birthday. And our birthdays are close together. And we're about 33, 34. And so I said, yeah, Jesus died when he was about our age. I was like, as long as I say about, that's okay. But it's just we can't state that dogmatically. But this is where it comes from. Matthew or John has Jesus going to Passover in Jerusalem three different times. And rather than simply being Galilee to Jerusalem, like the Synoptics, John's is more more complicated. First he has Jesus in Galilee, then to Jerusalem, then back through Samaria, to Cana of Galilee, back to Galilee, then back to Jerusalem again, then back to Galilee again, then to Jerusalem, then to Bethany, then finally to Jerusalem one more time. So John's geography is different than the others. All we have are the Synoptics, then for all we know, Jesus went to, his ministry might have lasted 1 year, and he went to Jerusalem at the end of it. But John gives us more information about that. In fact, probably when you read John, probably most of the action takes place in Jerusalem, in and around the temple. So geography, that's number five. Number six, John gives more attention to more of the apostles. John gives more attention to more of the apostles. Now, I guess Peter is still the main character, the main apostle in John. He still gets the most airtime, the most mention, just as in the others. John himself would be a close second. Remember, he calls himself the disciple whom Jesus loved in this book. But if I could say it this way, if you were an actor playing in one of the Gospels, you'd probably want to be in John because more of the apostles get speaking roles in John's Gospel. People who in the other three are really not a lot more than names in the list. Thomas, Thaddeus, Philip, people like other, if it weren't for John, we wouldn't know anything about them besides the fact that they were one of the 12 apostles, get speaking roles in John. So what are some of the apostles, who are some of the apostles who John talks more about, tells us more about, gives them more time, more speaking roles, etc.? One immediately comes to mind.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, Nathanael's not even mentioned. Yeah.
Chris says Nathanael. That's a couple of times where John uses names that aren't used in the other three. So like Nathanael's one of those. Traditionally, he's been identified with Bartholomew in the other three, in the list of the other Gospels. But he tells us about Nathanael. Remember the stories about Nathanael in the four Gospels? What main one comes to mind?
Well,
Yeah, he's a true Israelite. Israelite indeed, in whom there's no God. He tells about how Jesus calls Philip, and then Philip goes and calls Nathanael. And so stories there in chapter 1. He's also mentioned at the end as one of the ones who goes fishing with the Lord. And he's from Cana, which is where Jesus works a couple of the miracles here. Nathanael is one. Who's another? No, not Mark. Yes, yes, Andrew. Andrew has a couple of speaking parts in John that he doesn't have in the others. You recall in the feeding of the 5,000, Mark says, Andrew came to him and said, hey, there's a little boy here with some loaves and fish, but hey, what good is that amongst so many people? Yeah, John's the only one who tells us that it was Andrew there. So yeah, Andrew, and also you have Andrew going and calling his brother Peter in chapter 1. So it's like Andrew leads his brother to Christ in John's gospel. So Andrew would be another. Who's another? Go ahead. You do, with Judas, let me mention two Judases. With Judas the Iscariot, John is the one who tells us that when the woman anoints Jesus in Bethany at the end, Judas is the one who's like, this money could have been spent on the poor. You know, all this money this cost. And John tells us, yeah, he wasn't really concerned about the poor, but he was like the treasurer and he was a thief and he wanted to use the money on himself. It's like, the other three tell us that they all griped. John particularly tells us that Judas was the one who griped the most. And it helps make the connection of why Judas betrayed him at all. You know, because his betraying him happens right after that. So you got Judas Iscariot, more stuff there. There's also one guy, there's another of the apostles John refers to as Judas not Iscariot. And I think it's chapter 15. And Judas not Iscariot said to the Lord this. I think this Judas is usually identified with Thaddeus in the other three Gospels. But clearly Iscariot was the more famous one if you go down in history as Judas not Iscariot in the Gospels. But you have Judas not Iscariot. It has a line in John chapter 14. Two more that y'all haven't mentioned yet. One I thought you'd guess right off. Who? Peter definitely has unique things in John that aren't in the others. Yeah, he throws them under the bus. Right. Thomas. Yeah, in the other three Gospels, Thomas is a name in the list of the 12 apostles, but everything else particularly that we know about Thomas, including the famous doubting Thomas story, is unique to John. It's kind of sad, you know, that he goes down in history as doubting Thomas when, you know, at the end he's believing Thomas, you know, confessing Christ as Lord and God Thomas, but, you know, we know him as doubting Thomas because he did doubt the Lord in the story. But that's only in John. And Philip was the other that has more lines, in John than in the others. So John, I don't know, for whatever reason, John chose to highlight more of the apostles than the others did, including himself to some degree, even though he doesn't mention himself by name exactly. So that's number six. Number seven, his writing style is more personal and reflective rather than simply being descriptive. His writing style is more personal and reflective rather than simply being descriptive. Let me see if I can explain this where it makes sense. Here's what I don't mean. When I say that John is more personal and reflective, I don't mean that the other three Gospels are somehow like detached, disinterested biographies who just are telling you the facts, ma'am. It's not like Matthew was an atheist who thought that the story of Jesus was a wonderful human interest story that just needed to be told, and that's why he wrote his Gospel. No, it's very clear that all of the Gospels were written by Christians, by followers of Jesus who believed that he was the Son of God and who wanted us to believe it too. It's written on the first page of all the Gospels. Mark opens with the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So there's no doubt what Mark thinks about the guy he's writing about. Luke also wears it on his sleeve. He begins his Gospel by telling Theophilus, The reason I'm writing this to you is so that you'll be certain about the things you've been taught. So I don't mean that the other three are somehow impersonal at all, and that John is the one who really loves Jesus. I don't mean that. But what I do mean is this. I do mean that compared to John, the others feel a little more detached. Compared to John. That's what I mean when I say John's style just feels more personal. John is the only one who will write in the first person and speak of I and we. With the other three, other than the passage at the beginning of Luke that I just mentioned where he speaks directly to Theophilus, I can't immediately at least think of any time in which they write in the first person, in which they say I or we, or even just break the fourth wall and speak directly to the reader. I can't think of any times, but John does it all the time. So in the other three, it's easy to forget about the author altogether because they're always writing in the third person. They're telling you what happened. In John, it's harder to forget. John injects himself into the story more often, sometimes literally, as a character in the story. Or with John, he's more likely to give you his reflections on what happened. He's more likely to break from simply telling you what happened and then go off on a theological tangent and tell you, here's what it means. Here's why they did what they did. Or even, here's what I thought at the time and here's what I realized later. For example, look at chapter 12, verse 14. Chapter 12, verse 14. This is the triumphal entry, Jesus coming into Jerusalem. And they're throwing down, or they're waving palm branches. And incidentally, John is the only one who mentions the palm branches, too. But in verse 14, John tells us that Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, just as it is written, and he quotes Zechariah, "Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt." His disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things had been written about him and had been done to him. Notice there how John breaks from just telling the story and jumps ahead to the future after Jesus had been glorified. And John, in doing this, John is reminding the reader, yes, I was a witness of these things, but the way I'm telling you the story now is not necessarily the way I understood it at the time. There was a lot I didn't get at the time. There's a lot all of us didn't get. And it was only later, in light of Jesus' crucified, resurrected glory, that it all made sense. And it's from that angle that John is writing the story to us. And he alone is the one. Mark and Luke and Matthew just don't do this sort of thing. It's true, they are also writing post-resurrection with the benefit of hindsight, but John is the only one who makes us aware of that distance between what he thought at the time and what he understood later. So John's gospel is still descriptive like the others. It's telling us what happened, but it feels more personal. It feels more reflective. There's a lot more asides. There's a lot more where he breaks from telling the story and says, and here's what it meant. To see more examples of that, just look at how the gospel begins and how it ends. How it begins with the prologue Chris mentioned earlier. It begins with this 18-verse long prologue where instead of telling the story of Jesus' birth, telling you what happened, John goes back beyond Jesus' birth into eternity, and he explains the significance of Jesus' birth and who he was and why he came and what was happening. No other gospel has anything quite like the first 18 verses of John's gospel. And then, if you look at the end of John's gospel, chapter 21, verses 14 and 15, at the very end, John reveals his identity as the author, basically tells you, oh yeah, that disciple whom Jesus loved that I've been talking about since chapter 13, that's me. That's the one who's writing this story to you, speaking in the first person again. And then he ends in verse 25 by saying, Now, there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written? I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. That just feels different than anything Matthew does. Not necessarily better, but different. You just don't find that sort of thing in the Synoptic Gospels. John's style was more personal, more reflective, and I suspect that's probably why a lot of people like him best. Finally, number eight. He is more explicit about the deity of Christ. This is similar to the one we just looked at, but it's sort of more of an example. John is more explicit about the fact that Jesus is God. Now, if you've been with me through this whole series, you know it's not that Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't teach us that Jesus is God, while John does. No, they do. It's more a matter of how they teach it than whether they teach it. Here's what I mean. Matthew, Mark, and Luke tend to teach us about the deity of Christ by showing us what he did and how others responded to him. So, for example, they show us that Jesus claimed to be able to forgive sins, which is something only God has the authority to do. You remember the healing, the paralytic in Mark chapter 2. Son, your sins are forgiven you. Who is this guy that forgives sins? Only God can forgive sins. You're right. And Jesus, too, can forgive sins. So by showing us things that he did, he claimed to be able to forgive sins. He controlled the weather. He walked on water. Things that only God could do. They quote passages from the Old Testament that refer to Yahweh, God of Israel, and then apply them to Jesus. So, yes, the Synoptics teach us that Jesus is God, but by showing us what he did and how people responded. But John is more explicit. I mean, John just comes right out in our memory verse today, chapter 1, verse 1, and says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." That's more explicit. That's very plain. Or again, in verse 18 of chapter 1, or verse 14 rather, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." Verse 18, "No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, He has made Him known." Or, just as John himself explicitly confesses Jesus to be God at the beginning, he has Thomas confessing Jesus to be God at the end. Look at chapter 20, verse 27. Chapter 20, verse 27. This is where doubting Thomas becomes believing Thomas. And he says, Jesus says to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. And do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." My Lord and my God. The early church father Chrysostom put it like this, describing John's lofty spirit. He says, "For John doth not begin like the rest from beneath, but from above, from the same point at which he was aiming. And it was with a view to this that he composed the whole book. And not in the beginning only, but throughout all the gospel, he is more lofty than the rest." I think that's accurate. More lofty than the rest. More explicit about the deity of Christ than the others were. Finally, just a question before we briefly look at the outline. It may have to be really brief. Why does John differ so much from the Synoptics? Why does John differ so much? Two possible reasons. Number one, he probably wrote later. Throughout history, most scholars have viewed John as being written last of all the Gospels, some thinking it as much as 20 or 30 years after the one previously written. And if that's the case, then it could very well be that John was familiar with, if not the text of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he was certainly familiar with the events recorded in the other three Gospels. After all, he was there for a lot of what was recorded in the other three Gospels. But it's in all likelihood he was probably familiar with the written text of many of the other three Gospels, which would suggest that perhaps he wrote on purpose to sort of supplement the other three. So you already got these other three Gospels that have a lot in common. If I'm going to write another, let's tell some stories that haven't been told yet. All right, you see what I'm saying? So it may well be that since he wrote later, he deliberately chose to cover different ground. But second, we just have to remember they all four had a lot to draw on. They all four had a lot to draw on. Craig Blomberg said it like this: this is on your handout. We must resist the temptation to think that we have anything like an exhaustive account of Jesus' ministry. The types of things the Gospels narrate are no doubt representative selections of many other similar incidents. Or, as we just read, John himself says at the end of his Gospel, there's many other things Jesus said and did that aren't written in this book. If they were all written down, the world wouldn't be big enough to hold all the books. So when we think of why John's could differ so much, we got to remember, it's not like any of them was claiming that we're telling the whole story here. This is all that Jesus said and did. Now, they had a big pool to draw from. So while a lot of people might struggle with the fact that there's all these differences among the Gospels, I mean, personally, my bigger question is, like, with all that could have been written about the Lord Jesus, with all that he was said and did, why does three of them have to be so similar? You know, why cover the same ground in three different Gospels when they could all have been as different from each other as John was from the other three? And as I've said before, I don't know why. It may just be that the Lord knows we need repetition to learn these things, but I trust he's wise in giving us what he did in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and wise in giving us John, something a little different too. Any questions about any of that, or comments or thoughts? I'm just going to briefly touch on the other because this took longer than I thought. Anything else? Any questions or comments? Miss Sue, go ahead. Mike's on his way.
Could be. I think I've somebody. I think Jesse may have said something similar to me in the past.
Thank you. Could well be the witness of two or three. Anybody else? Just look right quick. I'm gonna let you make use of this handout, this outline, as you read John. I hope you will keep it by your side and use it. No outline is inspired. And if you look at different commentators' outlines, no two of them are the same. But this one was adapted from one by Craig Blomberg. Of all the ones I saw, I liked his the best. And notice that the book as a whole is divided into four parts: an introduction, chapter 1, a conclusion, chapter at the end, chapter 21, and the bulk of it, chapters 2 through 20, divided into two big parts, which many scholars refer to as the Book of Signs and the Book of Glory. Book of Signs and the Book of Glory. Now, those terms aren't infallible, but I have found that they stick in my memory better than some others that I've heard. So when it came to the question of, do I use Book of Signs or others I read, like Jesus' self-disclosure in Signs and Discourses, I'm like, Book of Signs it is. So I hope these stick in the mind here. Book of Signs and Book of Glory, roughly 2 through 12 for the Book of Signs, 13 through 20 for the Book of Glory. And just as some closing questions, why do you think that Book 1, chapters 2 through 12 are often referred to as the Book of Signs? What do we mean by signs? What does John mean by signs? Yeah, miracles. John uses this term for signs frequently in his gospel. And particularly in chapters 2 through 12, There are seven signs recorded in chapters 2 through 12. Anybody remember what they are? I'm going to put them up here in a second, but I want to see how many you can guess. Seven signs in the book of signs, chapters 2 through 12.
The first one was the wedding.
The first is, go ahead and look at that right quick, because 1 and 2 are significant. No pun intended. Significant. Significant. No pun intended. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 11 is the story of the Jesus turning the water into wine at the wedding in Cana. And notice in verse 11, John says, "This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." So that's the first. I'm going to go ahead and tell you the second one just because it's probably not the most famous. Turn over to chapter 4, verse 46. Are you going to talk about this today? In chapter 4. You're not going to get there, are you? In 4:46? Okay. The healing of the official's son. Notice in chapter 4, verse 46, John says, "So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine." Comes there back around from Jerusalem through Samaria and gets back to Cana again. And he works a miracle here, healing the official's son. And then in verse 54, John says, "This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee." I wanted to read these because these are the only two that John actually numbers. This is the first, this is the second, and they both took place in the same town, Cana of Galilee. So that's why Blomberg, if you'll notice, under 2A, he brackets this section off, chapters 2 through 4, as a sort of subsection. And the reason for that is this little sandwich here of two signs in Cana. So those are the first two. That leaves five. What are the other five?
I know the word is in the feeding of the 5,000.
Feeding of the 5,000.
And I know it's in chapter 11, the healing of Lazarus.
Healing of Lazarus. And, raising of Lazarus.
Sorry, and the blind man from birth.
Healing of the man blind from birth, chapter 9. I think that's five. That leaves two. Changing water into wine, chapter 2. Healing the royal official's son in Capernaum, chapter 4. Healing the man paralytic by the pool in Bethesda, chapter 5. Feeding the 5,000. Walking on water, chapter 6. Healing the man blind from birth. And finally, the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11. And John's not claiming that Jesus only did seven signs. There's places where it's clear he did many more. But these are the seven he explicitly details and tells us the story of. And looked at this way, the raising of Lazarus then becomes the sort of climactic sign in the book of signs, pointing forward to the big sign at the end when Jesus rises from the dead himself. Right? So those are the signs that we see. And this word, the word for sign here, occurs several times in John, including chapter 12, verse 47. Just go ahead and turn there and we'll stop there. In chapter 12, verse 37, this is the end. This is, comes at the end of what we're calling here the book of signs. And John says this: "When Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. And though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him, so that the word spoken by Isaiah would be fulfilled." So this, you can sort of tell John is sort of winding down this section in his gospel. All these signs I've told you, even the big one here, raising of Lazarus, they still don't believe in him. "You raised Lazarus? Well, we'll kill Lazarus." It's actually in there. They're plotting to kill Lazarus again. Because what do we do then, right, if we kill him? And they want to kill Jesus because he raises Lazarus from the dead. So after this mention here in chapter 12, the word sign doesn't occur again until near the end, after the resurrection. So the focus shifts to what they call the book of glory, which in John's gospel refers to Jesus being lifted up and glorified. We'll talk briefly about that next week, but I've about run out of time. Questions, comments from you? Pastor Carroll, would you close us in prayer?